The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. All right. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andrew Nurkin. I'm the Deputy Director for Enrichment and Civic Engagement here at the Free Library. Tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce not one, but two of the most vital writers of our moment, Kevin Young and Gregory Pardlow. Kevin Young is a poet, essayist, editor, cultural observer, and teacher. He directs the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library, our peer institution, and is the poetry editor of The New Yorker. He is the author of 13 books of poetry and prose, winner of the Lenore Marshall Prize for Poetry and the Ainsfield Wolf Book Award in Nonfiction, finalist for the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Los Angeles Times Books Prize. His new poetry collection, Brown, moves purposefully, inevitably, between the personal and the cultural, the bewildering past and the bewildering present, in search of those connecting threads that only poetry can show us. Gregory Pardlow's new book, Air Traffic, is the memoir of a poet, a son, a parent, and a wanderer, investigating the most challenging questions of race, class, and masculinity in America. His 2014 poetry collection, Digest, won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, was nominated for an NAACP Image Award, named a standout book by the Academy of American Poets, and was a New York Times Best Poetry Book of the Year. His first book, Totem, was selected by Brenda Hillman as the winner of the 2007 American Poetry Review Honickman First Book Prize, and he has won fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the New York Foundation for the Arts, Cave Canem, and the McDowell Colony. He was born right here in Philadelphia and teaches at Rutgers Camden. Please first welcome Gregory Pardlow to the stage.
Thank you. Thanks. Hello, everyone. Good evening. I'm thrilled to be here. This is my first time reading at the Free Public Library in Philadelphia. I've been here a number of times as an audience member. I think the first time I was here was for a reading in the mid-90s, and I was not even writing poems at the time. And I remember it was a literary festival citywide, and I went to an event at the International House by Penn. And Cave Canem was giving the reading, and it was raining, and I was so nervous that I couldn't bring myself to go inside, so I stood by the window outside in the rain with my ear against the window listening to the poets read, and I just thought it was just the pinnacle, the coolest thing to be anywhere near people who actually write poetry. I'm very honored to be with you tonight from this podium, reading with my friend Kevin Young, who I've long admired a great deal. So I was thinking I would read some bits that spoke to Philadelphia a little bit from the memoir In Essays, and it wasn't difficult to find any. So the book is riddled with Philadelphia references, so you might hear some stuff you recognize. Student union. We know the premise of the book. My dad was an air traffic controller. My family's from Philadelphia. I grew up in South Jersey across the river in Willingboro. Student union. Doctors tried to halt the infection at his ankle, but my father had ignored the rot for too long. He needed pruning all the way up to the knee and lost much of his right leg to diabetes. Sitting as close to upright as he could manage in the folding bed at Our Lady of Lourdes in Camden, he dragged on an electronic cigarette, which he'd made me smuggle in for him from the Wawa on Haddon Avenue on my way to the hospital. It was strangely rejuvenating buying cigarettes for my father again the way I had as a kid. He lit the thing, and a tiny diode where the ember should be pulsed like a blip on a radar screen, as if to echo his weak vitals. "You know Paddy Chayefsky?" my father asked. "Wrote a movie called The Hospital? Well, you'd like him." He released the vapor with relish. "The way you get the nursing staff to leave you alone? Press the call button. Guaranteed at least 10 minutes of undisturbed smoking if I press it." This was one of the lessons he'd taken from Chayefsky and applied to his current circumstances. He took pride in being able to project movie plots onto his life, and he believed deeply in the verity of plot contrivances sanctioned by the big screen. All the reminders of mortality around us put me in something of a clerical mood. I pried into the facts and milestones of my father's life, no longer afraid of him cutting me off or sending me out of the room. Greg Sr. got kicked out of Central High School in Philadelphia for truancy in 1965 and enrolled instead at the sprawling regional Germantown High. He told me that was where he became president of Germantown High's first black student union. I'd learned at a young age to adjust for the self-aggrandizement in my father's narratives. Problem was, so much of the way I interpret the world has come from the way he interprets it. I let him ramble. My father told me that his ambitions for the Black Student Union had been in no way altruistic. He wanted to master the master's tools, period. He wanted to show that he could, I guess, and he wanted to be seen doing it. He was more interested in the aesthetics of protest than in the real-world impact of changing social structures. As a teenager, my father led his band of protesters to sit-ins, be-ins, drum circles, and community centers. They appeared on the public broadcast station, WHYY, he claims, and also on the neoclassical steps of school buildings. Did they constitute the voice of a community? Did they actually represent anyone's interests beyond their own? The Black Student Union of Germantown High acquired a reputation for being well-mannered and articulate when, during a fateful school board meeting in the auditorium of Leeds Junior High, my father first responded to the words that became for him a rallying cry, a call to duty. "Young man," someone asked, "would you care to say a few words?" I imagine parents and administrators at school board meetings typically groaned and rolled their eyes at groups of young African-American toughs, arms folded in the aisles of auditoriums, wearing black turtlenecks under dark, explosive topiaries of hair. But after word got around of the speech my father gave that night at Leeds, the young radicals from Germantown High became welcome guests at such meetings. Committees began inviting my father's group to serve as a preemptive buffer against less mannered groups of activists. Other groups would arrive at a school board meeting prepared to disrupt its proceedings, only to fall silent upon recognizing my father among the white men seated behind the microphones. Central High School opened in 1838. It is the nation's second oldest continually operating public high school, and it remains among the highest performing public schools in the state of Pennsylvania. My grandfather, Samuel Pardlow Jr., graduated from this elite institution in 1939. He expected my father to replicate the rare achievement, which, he maintained, should have been easier for my father in the 1960s, given significant advances in race relations. My father responded to this pressure with a defensive machismo ill-suited for the classroom. He feared the vulnerability and the humility that the learning process, undertaken in earnest, requires. Once, when he was 9, my father took a walk through a park with Sam. I have a black and white photograph of the two of them, which I associate with this story, even though in the photograph, my father and grandfather are standing in the front yard of the family house in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, about 20 minutes outside of Philly. In the photograph, they're wearing what might be matching suits, but Sam, I know, wouldn't have gone for anything so cutesy. My dad's head is tilted at a playful angle, his mouth open as though he's in the middle of a song or telling Sam something amusing. Sam is expressionless, the disparity between their faces proving Sam's impatience. I set the still image in motion and watch as my father brings his as my grandfather brings his open hand up against the back of my father's head, smacking the shit out of the boy. The few times he retold this story, my father emphasized, strenuously, the lesson my grandfather was imparting, that with life being so unpredictable, you must always be on guard. No time for idle chatter. Still, I read my dad closely for signs of what must have unfolded after the shutter clicked on the photograph, the moment the smile was wiped from his face. The lesson could not have made sense to a boy that age. My father's subsequent refusal to make himself vulnerable to authority figures rendered a classical education like the one offered at Central untenable. The final exam for his AP philosophy class at Central helped him develop his unconscious fears into a working theory. A single directive was scrawled across the blackboard. Explain the transcendental I at the center of all consciousness. For 45 minutes, he told me, he sat contemplating the silence of the blank page. By the time the period ended, he felt as bereft as he did relieved. At the order to set pencils down, he scribbled his name, the only mark on his page, humbly in the corner, before handing in this evidence of his capacity for suffering. The confounding postscript was that he received an A on the exam, confusing and demoralizing the already distrustful student. To prepare, my father concluded, was to cheat. Instead, he was emboldened to rely more fully on spontaneity and verbal dexterity. Potential had followed my father through the halls of Central like a sullen weather system. But when he arrived at Germantown High, my father was made to feel that he had mental abilities near clairvoyance. His depression abated. Here were the people, he decided, from whom he had been estranged, the proletariat, and among them he would shine in the right measure. He was first recruited to lead the Controversy Club, a group of students pretending toward the cultural fringe. They were an interracial collection of hippies and potheads who enjoyed, if the name is to be taken at face value, discussing the controversial issues of the day. Through events hosted by the Controversy Club, my dad met several young black guys with whom he found he had many things in common, not the least of which being a sharp wit and a ready libido. It was through the Controversy Club, too, that he discovered his passion for smoking weed. Out of these new friends and others, my father formed the more selective Black Student Union. In need of branding and posters, they enlisted the services of Marion Parham, a light-skinned girl as tall as my dad, whom he had crushed on since childhood. Her nickname was Stretch. Legendary as the school's best artist, Stretch had graduated from Germantown High and was in her first year at Moore College of Art. My father had civic and personal motives for enlisting Stretch to the cause, not that either he or Stretch cared to separate idealism from romance. Dating would not be an accurate term for their agenda-bound relationship. One of the BSU's first offensives targeted that school board meeting at Leeds Junior High School in the Mount Airy section of, in the Mount Airy neighborhood. At issue was the unrest among the student body. The 1964 riot, 3 years earlier, on Philadelphia's Columbia Avenue, and the ones that summer in Newark and Plainfield, New Jersey, made tense what otherwise would have been dispassionate discussions around pedagogy, the achievement gap in performance between black and white students, and the adoption of a more culturally inclusive curriculum. Fear disguised itself as prudence. Jesse, Booth, Bubby, Ridge, and Pard, as my father was familiarly known, entered the auditorium and made themselves conspicuous. After sitting through half an hour of uninspiring political theater, my father, to play to the fear that the young men might leave and do something rash, instructed his cohort to make a show of walking out in exasperation. Whether it was my father's intended outcome or not, the chair of the meeting interrupted the discussion to set my father's future in motion. "Young man," he shouted, leaning into the microphone. "Young man, would you care to say a few words?" My father approached the floor mic at the foot of the stage and began. "What we have here is a failure to communicate." He cleared his throat and paused a moment enough to allow the audience's curiosity to flirt with worry. It only takes a cursory perusal to ascertain the disregard this august body has for the well-being of black youth. This ill will is deleterious both to these students, who make up the overwhelming majority of the student population, and the reputation of the public school system of our great and historic city. Rather than mire the conversation in resentment and suspicion, you, gentlemen, have an opportunity to demonstrate, as it was nearly 200 years ago, that Philadelphia is the beacon of wisdom to lead the nation forward through these troubled times. His rhetoric was further laced with lines he'd memorized from the St. Crispin's Day speech of Henry V, and from the Rudyard Kipling poem, If. The point here was not merely to persuade, but to dazzle. Versions and snippets of this oration reverberated years into the future via my father's penchant for self-reference. Turgid as it was, though, his speech moved the gentlemen of the school board. He told me one audience member offered to serve as his booking agent for speaking engagements. My father declined, but still, the seed was sown. A coalition of students from across the city organized a strike and the ill-fated 1967 march on the Philadelphia School Board building to protest the school board's apparent refusal, through inaction, to consider requests, which had become demands, to end tracking and mandatory vocational training. These demands were presented by the citywide student coalition led by then 18-year-old David Richardson. Later, the 201st District of Germantown would send Richardson, at 24 years old, the youngest in Pennsylvania history, to serve his first of 11 terms in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. My father and his Black Student Union played an instrumental role on the planning committee for the student strike, spending months meeting with Richardson and other activists in the basement of the Church of the Advocate and at Rendezvous, a popular nightclub that had become Richardson's unofficial office. I'm not sure if he told me this or if Didion is percolating here, but I will speculate that my father was enamored with the prospect of being seen on television, or perhaps seeing himself getting arrested, and that he had given a great deal of thought to the taglines he would shout at the camera as he was being shoved into a police car. But when the day of the student strike came, November 17th, 1967, neither he nor Jesse, his closest friend and confidant, was in attendance. My father had reestablished his practice of ditching school, but instead of joining the march, as months of planning suggested he would, he was in bed with his new girlfriend, Stretch. And Jesse was at home with his girlfriend, facts they would both obscure by later recounting to other members of the coalition, as if they had been present, events they simply watched on the broadcast news. Commissioner of Police Frank Rizzo, who would later be elected mayor of Philadelphia, is famously quoted as commanding the riot-geared police squad to get their black asses, unleashing an attack on the students. 22 were injured and more than 50 arrested. That passage by King Henry V forever soured my father's conscience with irony. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here and hold their manhoods cheap. I'm guessing I was conceived about 3 months after the student march. Bob, Sarah, Sam, and Ollie, all four of my grandparents, considered themselves of a social standing that did not permit being grandparents in their early 40s, which made my parents pariahs to their respective families. Claiming they planned to participate in the Solidarity Day march, the last gasp of Martin Luther King Jr.'s by then posthumous Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C., Stretch and Big Greg eloped, Freedom Riders for Love, on a bus to South Carolina. He sported a gray suit his mother bought for him to wear on formal occasions. My mother, whose pregnancy was not yet showing, wore a white mini dress and matching go-go boots. She was almost 21, and my father was almost 19. Newlywed and expecting, Big Greg was eligible for a Class 3A exemption from the draft because of the hardship military service would pose to his wife and child. But he also would have gotten a Class 1SC deferment, which he could claim as a college student. I like to think his decision to marry my mother resulted from more than convenience and opportunism, or that they believed, however naively, they might fulfill the promise of their lives while raising a child, or that it was an inkling of the blind commitment to pride that would be his repeated undoing over the years. Having been offered and accepted a full ride at what was then Cheney State College, the oldest historically black college in the nation, my father improvised an income through speaking engagements, lectures, tutoring, and mentoring programs. "I taught black kids how not to scare white folks," he once told me. This supported him and his young family until the demands of his ambition outstripped the limits being a student placed on that ambition, and he resolved to drop out of college in order to pursue his activism full time, prophetically casting his eyes skyward like the fashionable pose modeled in images of populist revolutionaries. My maternal grandfather, Bob Parham, who began his career as a technician for the Federal Aviation Administration, was held in such esteem by the early 70s that he was allowed to spearhead an initiative to recruit and prepare minorities and women for careers in air traffic control. Bob traveled across the country, but he was based at Philadelphia International Airport, in the city his ancestors had called home for five generations. Bob taught recruits, preparing them for the civil service exam, the first hurdle toward qualifying for training at the FAA Academy in Oklahoma City. For years, the exam had proved inscrutable to nearly all but white men with either a college education or closely comparable military experience. In the political environment of the day, however, a glaring lack of diversity among public employees was a liability for federal institutions, legally as well as morally. The Equal Employment Opportunity Program that Bob oversaw supported recruits like my dad. Bob's distaste for the young man who'd led his daughter astray was now outweighed by the need to provide for a grandson, and he invited my father to participate in the EEO program, although Big Greg was too proud to accept his father-in-law's help unconditionally. "He almost got me fired," Bob said, recalling the havoc caused by my father's performance on the civil service aptitude test for air traffic control. The matter came to his supervisor's attention because my father scored suspiciously high on the exam. Someone, therefore, accused Bob not only of preparing my father for the test according to the program's mandate, but also of feeding him the answers. In fact, however, both men confirmed that my dad had refused Bob's preparatory course altogether. Yes, he'd accepted Bob's invitation to shepherd him through the formalities, but my father refused to grant that kind of access, he told me, to his new father-in-law. He would not let Bob see him in the vulnerable state of apprenticeship. Beyond that, my father wanted to prove how useless, how far beneath him, was Bob's condescending notion of tutelage. In my father's version of the story, he did so well on the original exam that not only did he prove himself beyond the need for any help from Bob, but the FAA brass, incredulous, refused to accept his score was possible. They demanded he sit for an oral exam with FAA officials to see for themselves the young man who claimed to have had no left-handed support. They had no idea how they were playing to his ego. Thank you.
That was great. I'm going to grab my water. How's everyone tonight? Good, that was terrific. It is indeed an honor to read with Greg, who I've known a while and admired for even longer than I've known him, so that's really a pleasure. I'm reading tonight mostly from my book of poetry. I've been on the road with prose, so it's nice to have Greg do the prose for a minute. My book is called Brown. It's a book that thinks about brownness in lots of different ways. Skin, I suppose, of course, but also John Brown, James Brown, and Linda Brown of Brown v. Board, who makes an appearance, not least of which because growing up in Topeka, Kansas, like I did in part, Linda Brown played piano at my church and sang, and I knew her growing up. It starts with and kind of continues with trains. Those beautiful emblems of travel, freedom, escape. And this poem is called That-A-Way. And I was inspired by Jacob Lawrence, the great painter's paintings in the Migration series that he did. And this is a speaker in the American South, thinking about moving north or west to places like Philly. That-a-way, there's an epigraph, and the migrants kept coming, Jacob Lawrence. Was walking and then waiting for a train, the 12:40, to take us that-a-way. I got there early. Wasn't a train exactly, but a chariot or the Crescent Limited come to carry me some home I didn't yet know. There were those of us not ready till good Jim swung from a tree and the white folks crowded the souvenir photo's frame. Let his body blacken, the extremities shorn, not shed but skimmed off so close it can be shaving almost. An ear in a pocket on a shelf, a warning where a book could go, so I got there early. See now, it was morning, a cold snap, first frost, which comes even here and kills the worms out the deer. You can hunt him then, but we never did want after. No trophy, crowned down from a wall, watching just a meal. What we might make last till spring. There are ways of keeping a thing. Then there are ways of leaving, and also the one way, that we didn't want. I got there early, luggage less sturdy, cardboard striped, black than my hat. Shoebox of what I shan't say, lunch on my lap. The noise, the rails made even before the train, a giant stomach growling, a bowed belly. I did not pray. I got there early. It was not no wish, but a way. So I ended up writing a lot about public figures, people we share, including Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron, of course, Hammerin' Hank, one of the greats, baseball players and great figures, really. Fascinating guy, and ended his career with the Braves. And there he broke Hank Aaron's Babe Ruth's home run record, you'll remember, in 1974. And this is a open letter to Hank Aaron, and it's about that instance. It mentions the hate mail he got, of which he got just reams and reams. Open letter to Hank Aaron. Your folded jersey said it best, brave. A bounty on your head, last name a prophet's, first a king. You kept swinging that hammer, bad Henry, even after the threats fell like hail. Every barbershop's expert already knew you would best Ruth's sacred record, just like they knew the Babe was really black. Ever see that nose of his? The hate mail you quit opening kept coming, scrawled or sutured, brushing you back more than a Hoot Gibson inside pitch. No return address. The newspaper with your obit already written, primed to run. Still, you swung like a boxer in the late rounds, hoping to change the judge's minds. Once you connect and the ball barely sails off over the short porch and left, you don't so much run as pace around the bases. Nonchalant, nervous, a man with too much cash worrying his pockets, a windfall he may never live long enough to spend. Rounding second, two guys race up to you, friend or foe, clapping you on the back. I hear they're doctors now, as if you'd just been born. Hopping the fence like that ball did, your mama bear hugs you headed home. Think of it as money, the bank card billboard you cleared in left field says. Not that you did. After the microphones aimed at your face like arrows into a saint, your face less belief than relief. I just thank God, you say, it's over with. Falling back into the crowd, unharmed, you wave your blue arms. So there's a sequence about playing baseball, mostly in Kansas. Little League, not professional, in case you were wondering or worried. So I'll just read two from this little sequence called Mercy Rule. Flame-tempered. I only owned one bat, my favorite. Roberto Clemente's name burnt into the wood. Length 27, I think. A yellow plank lathed off some tree in Kentucky. I swung that slugger often as I could, not knowing Clemente except what Dad had told me. He was a man who loved people, who tried doing good, so was dead. Later, when our racist neighbor wouldn't let me spin on her swing set, "You can play," she said, freckled, aiming a finger at my friend, "but he can't," calling me out. I thought of my Clemente bat, that off-duty Dad leaned in the front closet in case anyone dared break in. So when she went and called me an N, I called her honky back. Stung, she yelled for her daddy, who emerged no matter what she'd said and threatened me from his short porch till I split some black kid who dared talk back like Clemente's bat. Even then, I knew you weren't supposed to do that. Only later did I learn Clemente means mercy. The division. We played in blue jeans. Unlike other teams in their tidy pal uniforms the cops paid for, we were outlaws, our hats dark, maroon shirts with our names on the back, skin brown and black and in between. We played a mean game, if only after a season of being the bad news bears, losing, umps even invoking the mercy rule some games. We'd wake and pray for rain or an ankle sprain. One day something gave way, the spokes, they turned, and all of a sudden we won, beating teams twice our size who'd skunked us before, giving goose eggs to kids in golden sleeves and tall corn-yellow socks, their new cleats aimed at our shins. We were our own Negro League. Our mascot was Reggie, chubby, goofy. Marcel, the relief, and Damien, our best pitcher, his long nails stabbing the stitches, his wind-up quick, change clipping the corner of the dish. I even saved one game. Bases loaded, the bullpen spent or gone wild, the backup, pitcher's backup, I threw slow but straight, the final strike turtling across the plate. The team hoisted me high that night, our fathers for once smiling wide. Our final game, we took first place and won the division. The sore faces the losing team wore, less shock or disbelief, that you could take, than disgrace and plain rage. The mask of their catcher tossed into the Kansas dust. Anger sat there, uneasy and too easy. Even their parents hated us, claimed to have forgotten our trophies. Who cared if they couldn't take watching us celebrate? That for the required final handshake, good game, they christened their palms with spit. Later, we'd wash up clean and sprinkles or chocolate dip hid our ice cream, vanishing. So I was writing about baseball and my childhood, and I realized I had some poems to write about my son's childhood and boyhood, and you know, some of the things he faced that were oddly exactly the same as what I did. But I wanted to think about that. I had sort of sworn after writing about him being born and his early childhood before he could talk, that I wouldn't write about him after he could speak, in case he'd sue me later. but we'll see. We're taking a chance. This poem's called I Doubt It. I Doubt It. It's as if you have died when I head into your room. Only its aging bears tucked in at night. Everything just as you left it, but quiet, to switch off the lone night light. Well, you are just down the street at our neighbor boy's sleepover, turning 9 tonight, where surely you barely sleep. I bet you're up drinking apple juice the way we once downed soda or pop or root beer, RC or Atari by the leader, playing war and bullshit. What we codenamed, I Doubt It, though we boys were full of confidence. Sleeping bags, a war zone where nobody died or got sent home, where we'd play fight and camp out and need no light to keep us company till dawn. This is how we learnt about tomorrow, when I will wander over and tug you back where you also belong, by the hand, somewhat awake, sleeping bag under your arm, empty as a chrysalis. So when I was writing this book, I was also in the midst of events that would cause and form Black Lives Matter. And I think that's one reason why that empty room resonated so much to me. I thought I'd read just a couple more poems. This is a poem about Emmett Till, whose death you may recall in 1955 galvanized the civil rights movement, his lynching in Mississippi. And I was down writing what's ended up being a libretto that's in the book. And we were just 10 miles from where he was killed in Greenwood. He was killed in Money, Mississippi. And so this poem is called Money Road. It's for John T. Edge. On the way to Money, Mississippi, we see little ghosts of snow, falling faint as words while we try to find Robert Johnson's muddy, maybe grave. Beside Little Zion, along the highway side, this stone keeps its offerings, bud and Louisiana hot sauce, the ground giving way beneath our feet. The blues always dance cheek to cheek with the church, Booker's place back in Greenwood, still standing. Its long green bar, beautiful Friendship Church, just a holler away. Shotgun, shotgun, shotgun. Rows of colored houses as if the same can of bright stain might cover the sins of rotting wood, now mostly tar paper and graffiti holding McLaren Street together. R.I.P. Bucci. The undead walk these streets seeking something we take pictures of and soon flee. The hood of a car yawns open in awe. Men's heads peer in its lion's mouth seeking their share. For sale, squash and snap beans. The midden of oyster shells behind Lusco's, the tiny O of a bullet hole in Booker's plate glass window. Even the Salvation Army thrift store closed, bars over every door. We're on our way again, away, along the money road, past grand houses and porte cochères set back from the lane, crossing the bridge to find markers of what's no more there. Even the underpass bears a name. It's all too grave, the fake sharecropper homes of Tallahatchie Flats rented out along the road, staged bottle trees chasing away nothing, the new outhouse whose crescent door foreign tourists pay extra for. Cotton planted in strict rows just for show. A quiet snow globe of pain I want to shake. While the flakes fall like ash, we race the train to reach the place Emmett Till last whistled or smiled or did nothing. money more a crossroads than the crossroads be. Its gnarled tree, the Bryant store facing the tracks, now turned the color of earth, tumbling down slow as the snow, white and insistent as the woman who sent word of that uppity boy, her men who yanked you out your uncle's home into the yard, into oblivion, into this store, abutting the money ginkgo, whose sign, worn away, now reads un or sin, I swear, whose giant gin fans, like those lashed and anchored to your beaten body, still turn. Shot, dumped, dredged, your face not even a mask, a marred, unspared, sightless stump. All your mother insists we must see to know what they did to my baby. The true Tallahatchie twisting south, the Delta death's second cousin once removed. You down for only the summer to leave the stifling city where later you will be waked, displayed, defiant, a dark glass. There are things that cannot be seen, but must be. Buried barely, this place no one can keep, yet how to kill a ghost? The fog of our outdoor talk. We breathe, we grieve, we drink our tidy drinks. I think now winter will out. The snow bless and kiss this cursed earth, or is it cussed? I don't yet know. Let the cold keep still your bones. So this is the last poem I'll read and the last poem in the book. It's called Hive. I think it's something of a fable, I'm not sure. Hive. The honeybee's exile is almost complete. You can carry them from hive to hive, the child thought, and that is what he tried, walking with them thronging between his pressed palms. Let him be right. Let the gods look away, as always. Let this boy, who carries the entire actual whirring world in his calm, unwashed hands, barely walking, bear us all there, buzzing, unstung. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much for those powerful readings. We're ready for the Q&A. Who would like to start us off? Please raise your hand and we will get a microphone to you. Someone has to be first. But it might be me. I'm going to start with a very obvious question, which is if you could talk a little bit about the difference for you both in terms of writing, but also in terms of sharing a memoir or a nonfiction piece versus poetry?
That's the hardest question. Thanks for starting with the hardest one. I mean, I think that I don't see them as so far removed from each other. I mean, I don't. It was so wonderful to hear that, by the way. I'm really eager to dig into the whole book, but it was so lively and filled with not just memory, but sort of portraits of everyone. I thought that was really powerful. And for me, you know, you just have a little more, it's not even time, because I think prose, you have to create kind of characters, even though it's, in both our cases, nonfiction. In my book, Bunk, I was really interested in P.T. Barnum, once I realized he was a character and sort of starts the book, and the book talks about fakery from Barnum to the present in American life. So it's a long book. It's not short. and I, you know, once I realized he was a character, that's when the book really became itself, you know. And once I realized that there were other figures who kind of took up the story, Stephen Glass, who faked at the New Republic, or Jason Blair, who faked at the New York Times, or figures people don't think about as much now, I think that's when it really came to life. And in writing Brown, I really had these figures, and when that book, I think, became itself is when I realized that, you know, writing about Hank Aaron wasn't so far away from me trying to write about what it was like playing ball, you know, just a few years later in Kansas, you know, what it meant to win something. We were terrible, you know, for half a season, and then being really good and then being denied sort of the pleasures of that, or the victory, as it were. And, you know, wrestling with that, that's when that book became itself. So in a way, you know, you have to kind of have yourself be not necessarily a character, but a figure, an eye that sees.
Yeah, I think the difficulty for me, or the challenge for me at any rate, was wrestling the material into a kind of narrative, into a linear arc. Because, you know, thinking in poetry, I'm inclined to think in images and character and think about the language and just the scenes. But then giving it some logic of moving from one location to another location, in time, that is, that was something that I'm not used to doing. But that would probably be the only genre distinction between writing poetry and nonfiction for me. The more I think about it and the more I talk about it, the less I believe in the idea that there's some natural distinction between poetry and prose, that there is that. Somebody asked me years ago if I believe in genre, right? And I think, interestingly, that starts with the premise that genre is a belief system. And so, at the time, I was very, you know, gung-ho, poetry. Yes, of course I believe in genre. I'm a poet, and we write poetry. We don't do that other stuff. But having spent years working on this book, I believe that there are just conventions that we play toward, but the project itself is still very much, you know, I'm still absolutely concerned with the language. I'm still very much concerned with giving the reader a kind of presence within the text, and the objectives are still the same.
Mr. Young, I want to ask you, in listening to you, the genre, to use the word, that I thought of was the Old Testament prophet, because it's poetry, it's discernment, it's trying to get at the truth. And I just wonder if you see any connection.
Between me and the Old Testament? The prophet, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I would say that I would be curious what Greg thinks, but I think that for me, both poetry and prose have that quality. When I was writing Bunk, I was having to declare things. I tried hard not to make it a Jeremiah, but, you know, there was qualities of saying, this is happening right now. You know, we're in a bad patch of fakes and hoaxes, and it's only getting worse, and the hoaxes themselves are about much more terrible things when once upon a time they were kind of praiseworthy, even if they were a little bit messed up. And then a few years ago, that became super true. And I was like, I was right. You know, it was a strange kind of prophetic feeling. But I think the poets and the writers I like, people like James Baldwin, are like that, or Lucille Clifton. She is deeply concerned with prophecy. And in my own poetry, this book especially has kind of a range of views and really voices. And especially in that Emmett Till poem and some of the longer sequences, I was really interested in airing out some of what I think might start to look that way, certainly in Emmett Till's body. We see transformation. We see or hope for, you know, that in a positive way. But of course, we see its degradation and its violence. This violence that, you know, is deeply American. And I was trying to understand that, and understand that with all that was happening in the news and all that was happening sort of in my son getting older, and imagining what, you know, the family of Tamir Rice might feel, or all these figures who I think are around us. So I hope there's some quality of that. And the center title poem is very much a poem about this redemptive tradition of the African-American church, seen through this church that I went to that Linda Brown sang at.
Yeah, I think, so I started out writing with the idea that I was going to write something of a labor history, that I was, that the book was going to be just kind of research and you know, just spend
it's
a lot.
It's not a labor history?
But I think it's because, you know, this, the inclination, and any writer who's doing the work honestly and pursuing this, the idea of truth slash beauty, right, is I think necessarily going to be in tune with the, or influenced by the world around them as they're writing, and so this kind of historically fact-based labor history then begins to speak to all of the concerns that we have going on today with the, you know, the crushing of the unions, or the anti-union sentiment, certainly. Questions that came up in the writing process were questions of community. So the idea of the union wasn't simply a labor union. Now it's the marriage union. Now it's the community. Now it's the race. Right? There's how do we form these bonding groups, and toward what end do we form these bonding groups? Now it's the nation. Right? And so that all of the conflicts that and the ways our discourse gets sort of weaponized toward the effort at creating and maintaining a union, a national union, you know, that we call the United States. All of these questions then, you know, what I started out as thinking was a very cut and dried kind of fact-based thing, now takes on symbolic meaning. And I think it necessarily does by virtue of being open to the world and vulnerable to the world that that we're working in and writing in.
I came in during your reading, Mr. Partlow, but I hope my question can allow you to elaborate.
I'm sure it's fine.
And for both of you, I'm interested in how your work is functioning as a kind of rumination on contemporary and historical Black masculinities. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you would you know, respond that if, in fact, you see that as a concern playing out in your work, and if so, how?
Sons and fathers, we don't yes. We're not obsessed with those at all, man. You know, it's interesting because for me, this book was kind of a departure and a return, like all books. You know, in a way, I had written about my father dying and my son being born in that kind of moment. But I was really interested in the fact of that, but also the feeling and the kind of grief world that you enter when you lose someone close to you. And then this other world, which is also complete with a language of pregnancy. And so how do you kind of, as a dude, think about that? I think that was very much what I was thinking about. This book, I think, thinks about blackness and brownness in a more explicit way. though, of course, all of that was there in Book of Hours, my previous book. So, you know, I think I was very aware, you know, having a young black son of dangers to him and sort of the rituals of childhood and of boyhood specifically. How have those changed? You know, are they different? And I think they are in many, many ways. He plays flag football, not tackle football, or kill the man with the ball, as we used to play. And there's a poem that talks about that, and it's less polite terms. But also these rituals of boyhood that, you know, are in that poem, I doubt it. And those in contrast, but also as part of this world we're in, where the danger that was always there to young black people gets shown on the news. And you have to decide how much you talk about with your child, you know. How much do you warn them or protect them or guide them? Things that black parents have thought about for eons. But it's a strange moment to see it on YouTube or see it on Twitter, you know, click and you see a murder, you know. This is a thing that we haven't totally absorbed or seen before. And I think that its presence sort of hovers over the book and beneath the book. And a lot of this has to do with masculinity, but all of it has to do with Americanness and this particular moment we're in.
So you're there's several intersections, one being your invocation of Emmett Till, and we discover years later that he did not, in fact, whistle at the woman.
Of course he did nothing.
He did nothing.
I mean, that's the thing that disgusts me, is that we can admit that, oh, it was wrong, but we still, even in our, we have this kind of notion that he might have done something.
Right.
Like, there isn't just plain old, you know, the most racist racists on the face of racism who, you know, got off and then sold their story. We somehow believe that there was some justification in their minds. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, and yeah, just to add to that, the whole Starbucks thing, you know, of course, you know, when the story comes out, they had to know something, right? They couldn't have been just because they were sitting there. Well,
sitting while black.
Yes, in fact, that's exactly, there was absolutely nothing more to the story. But speaking about the Emmett Till, though, one of the long concerns for me was this, because as a black man, I grew up having internalized the sense that there was something already guilty about my masculinity and certainly about my sexuality, that any kind of awareness or acknowledgement that I'm a sexual being in the world was certainly threatening, and was threatening outwardly and would ultimately put myself in danger. And to contrast that certain knowledge that, you know, sexuality, black male sexuality is monstrous in this society, with my father, who was, you know, I guess it certainly had something to do with his generation, but he was, you know, had free love. I mean, he just, you know, hippie to the core. And to the point that we also know about the generations, which hasn't changed, and we're discovering too at all, is the virulent sexism of that is in that. And so American masculinity is absolutely guilty and threatening. There's something very wrong with American masculinity. And there is something, you know, to contrast that with the implied guilt or the scapegoating of black masculinity. You know, so I'm thinking through how to talk about this now, but these are the questions very much that I'm sort of working with in this book. How do I reconcile these conflicting impulses and messages? There's one other thing about this.
Well, of course, as I said earlier, you know, writing within the historical moment and being sensitive to the historical moment, I can't help but be influenced by the Me Too conversations, right? So these also begin to play into my concerns and questions about Black masculinity, about masculinity, American masculinity, as compared to what I think of as more enlightened masculinities around the world, other expressions of masculinity. What is possible? So yeah, please.
Could you speak to one of these things about going from poetry to prose? I'm interested in, Greg, you mentioned about trying to come to terms with the long arc of writing mm-hmm. a memoir. Mm-hmm. How did you figure that out, or how did you go about learning that? And I guess on the sentence level, thinking about the line break and then trying to, I mean, I know the sentence is part of the poem also, but did you have to think about sentences differently in prose and straightening out the rhythm, or did that actually give you momentum?
No, that's a great question. I think you're right that with the poems, I'm thinking in lines, but in the prose, I am very much thinking in sentences. I'm writing toward grammar, whereas excuse me, with the poetry, I'm writing perhaps more toward music. But the sad or the guilty admission is that I didn't have an overall any guiding plan to organizing the book, and in fact it's all very organic. I wrote a bunch of essays and put them together, and then just tried to figure out how the puzzle pieces fit, and then put a little connective tissue between them, and you know, and try to cut and paste and make it sound like they were that way to begin with. But it was all very kind of, you know, just made it up as I went along. Yeah.
Just in terms of narrative, I feel like I'm right to discover, you know, and so sometimes with prose, that's not my favorite thing, you know, because you get really far into a process, and for me, I was thought I'd write a slim meditation on hoaxes and the nature of truth, and then I realized that it's everywhere, you know. I must sort of think about it and think about the history. And what helped me organize it, my prose book, was understand that it was a history, that it wasn't sort of a meditation, and a history demands a certain different kind of tact. And that really helped me a lot. And this book, Brown, had an almost similar thing where I kind of realized, instead of it being a public history over here and a private history over there, which at one time it was, they were kind of separated, the poems about, you know, sports figures or Black figures and poems about my childhood. And then I realized that they were talking to each other. And that's when it became, in that public and private were similar, if not the same. That's when it became its own kind of narrative, though, of a lyric connectivity and form.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join
Thanks,
me
y'all.
In thanking our authors.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.